Radio. Morning, everybody. You're listening to On the Air with Glenn Coble, and our special guest today, as I bring his phone up, is Fred Malone. Hey, Fred, you there?
I'm with you.
All right. I'm going to can this music here. Hang on. All right, there we go. Now we're back on. All right, Fred, you were talking about all sorts of interesting things.
Yeah, White House pets is the topic right now we're on. Before I forget, I wanted to ask you, I know you're going to be leaving for California soon.
Yeah.
Will you be back by the 21st of April for our next time on the air?
Or? I think I will be.
Okay.
I'm going to have to let you kind of know after the fact. But
Well, I will plan on it, and then if for some reason you aren't, that's no problem. We'll just carry it on to the next month.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be back by then.
Yeah, that's the third Thursday.
I'm going to be leaving California on the, I forget, about the 10th. So, yeah, unless the river rises and something bad happens, I'll be back for that.
All right, we'll hope that California doesn't break off and sink into the ocean.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, my son had an earthquake 5.5 miles from his house.
Oh, really?
About 2 weeks ago, yeah.
And what town do they live in?
Ojai.
Ojai, sure. Okay.
And it was very mild, so it wasn't bad. But they did feel it and did hear it, so.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
All right, well, continuing on.
Yeah.
We mentioned FALA earlier.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk a little bit about FALA.
Oh, good.
Before FDR acquired FALA, he had a dog by the name of Major.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure what breed it was. This book didn't indicate what breed Major was, but Major had a tendency to bite people. So
well, isn't that true of the Major in our White House?
Well, didn't Biden have a dog with the name of Major that bit people,
that
or was
people.
That the
yeah.
dog? I can't remember now.
I don't know. It was one,
yeah, one of the two.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, he had to banish Major from the White House, and he acquired FALA.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, FALA was very popular with the people. You know, everyone knew FALA, very adoring to the public.
Yeah.
He actually traveled to Hawaii with FDR on the U.S. Navy cruiser Baltimore in 1944.
Yeah.
Right toward the end of the war.
Yeah.
FALA temporarily wandered off, and they didn't know what happened to him while he was on board this cruiser. And then he reappeared mysteriously with much of his hair missing.
Wow!
And they started doing a little bit of investigation, and what they found out was FALA had gone down below deck where all the sailors were. I guess they kind of lured him away for a friendly visit, so to speak.
Yeah.
And while he was there, they were plucking his hair for souvenirs.
Oh, my.
So when he reappeared to FDR, he had a lot of hair gone.
Well, that's kind of interesting because Scotties are... we had a Scottie when I was young, and Scotties, you do pluck their hair, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Yeah. They have two coats. coats. They have a soft coat and a really hard, a wire.
A bristly coat, yeah.
Yeah, and you do, I think you pluck out the soft coat.
No, I'll be darned. Well, I had a couple of, I had, we have some friends that had two Scotties, who have both passed away now, and I never really noticed about them plucking hair, but I thought that was kind of interesting. But, you know, that's typical, you know, of people wanting a souvenir from the president, so they couldn't pluck FDR's hair, they plucked the dog's hair.
That's what happened to the back of my head, too. All the girls kept plucking the hair out of my
that
head.
That must be what's happening to mine now. Of course, dogs have always been pampered pets in the White House. The Washington Children's Museum hired an interior decorator to build Ronald Reagan's dog Rex a doghouse, complete with small portraits of both Ron and Nancy on the inner walls.
Oh, boy.
Can you believe that?
Yes, I can.
And another kind of shaggy dog story, Jerry Ford would signal to his dog Liberty, remember Liberty?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I remember Liberty, to run into the Oval Office as a distraction when it was time to end a visitor's time.
Kind of like you having your secretary give you a call.
Yeah, right. You got a call on the line. Well, yeah. Jerry Ford would just signal to the dog. The dog would come in and he'd say, oh, I got to take my dog out. You know.
I love it.
And Richard Nixon's dog, King Timahoe, liked to shake hands with visitors.
Well, of course.
I don't remember much about that dog.
I don't either.
Yeah,
but
I
you know, when the dog shakes your hands, it wants a treat.
Well, usually, yeah. But I don't remember that dog at all. Of course, one of the most popular dogs of all time, besides Fowler, to live in the White House was Warren Harding's dog, Laddie Boy.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, for people in Marion, everyone does knows Laddie Boy.
Sure,
but
we do.
Laddie Boy had a number of songs written about him.
Really?
Over the years, he was always at Harding's side. We have several photographs down at the museum in the Harding rooms, and Laddie Boy is in all of them. Hmm. There's one, my particularly one that I love. There must be 500 people in this photograph. It's a big yard-long picture, you know, panoramic view. And these people are all standing in front of the White House, a lot of foreign dignitaries and all that. Harding is right in the middle, and right at Harding's feet is Laddie Boy.
Huh.
Yeah, it's amazing. All these famous, you know, influential kings and queens and leaders,
yep.
And there's the dog.
I'll be
there. Laddie Boy was destined to become immortalized because when they were building the Harding Memorial, school children donated pennies.
To help build it.
That memorial, of course, was built with no public money. It was all private donations, mostly from people donating, you know, $1, $2, and kids with pennies. So when the memorial was completed and paid for, there was some money left over. A lot of these were the children's pennies. So the pennies were melted down, and there were 100 copper statues of Laddie Boy made.
I'll be darned.
Now,
he was an Airedale, by the way.
Where all of them are today. However, we have one in our collection at the museum.
Wow.
One of those Penny's dogs.
He was an Airedale.
He was an Airedale, right. Now, of course, a lot of people think he came from Walter Lingo's out at Les Rues, but he was not.
Huh.
He was actually a gift from a Secret Service, not Secret Service agent, but a friend when they were in Washington when he was a senator there.
Well, now, he didn't live very long. He only lived 8 years, I just found out.
Laddie Boy?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was still alive when Harding died.
Yeah.
And when Mrs. Harding moved from Washington back to Marion, she gave Laddie Boy to us to their Secret Service agent in Washington.
And then he died in 1929,
yeah,
I just
so
found out.
Yeah, so he didn't actually come back. Yeah.
Huh.
But he was very celebrated. He was once interviewed by the Washington Star. And another time was a central figure at a birthday party, his own, of course, with all the neighborhood dogs as guests.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah.
And we have a lady has donated $1,000 for information trying to find his collar, and that's still out there.
Yeah, well, of course, it's been missing now for probably close to 10 years,
yeah,
I would say.
Yeah, it has been a while, yeah.
Yeah. Another former newspaperman, Harding's... Harding's sudden death in San Francisco, you know, the newsboys began they're the ones that actually started the penny drive, and they were asking for at least one penny from each newsboy. They collected 19,134 pennies. And there is one statue, I understand, in the Smithsonian, but as far as the others are concerned, we do not know where they are. They were given to dignitaries at the time of the opening of the memorial here in Marion.
Okay.
So I would imagine like President Hoover and President Coolidge, people like that, and members of the cabinet were given these statues. But we do have one on in our collection at the museum, and people can see that if they come tonight at Heritage Hall.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say.
On the 26th, yeah. Right. They can actually see that. It's in the Harding Room. So.
Huh, interesting. And that's made from melted down pennies?
Melted down pennies, yes, that were left over from the collection that was done when they built the memorial, right?
Now, it's probably pretty valuable because copper is pretty valuable right now.
Well, it's obviously very valuable in the sense that it was a limited edition of 100.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That in itself would make it a very valuable thing.
Sure would.
And, of course, as we all know, any presidential collectible these days is a valuable commodity to own. I personally own four pieces of President McKinley and Ida McKinley's personal effects that were handed down through our family. So
that's
I feel
cool.
Fortunate for that.
Yeah.
And, of course, when I'm gone, they'll go to the McKinley Museum up in Canton.
I have absolutely nothing for
Among the nation's earliest president, horses were very favorite and sometimes became very famous pets. Former General Zachary Taylor, remember Zachary Taylor?
Yeah, I do.
Who was very instrumental in the Mexican War during James Polk's term in office.
I want to amend that, by the way. I don't remember him personally.
Well, I can't say that I know him personally. However, I have portrayed James Polk before and have enacted Zachary Taylor's name.
Mm-hmm.
He was called Old Rough and Ready. Remember that?
I do remember that.
But his Mexican war mount was named Old Whitey. And Old Whitey, of course, survived the Mexican-American War, the Mexican-American War, as did Zachary Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
And when Taylor became president, he brought Whitey to the White House, and Whitey was known to graze on the grass at the White House lawn.
Oh, that's cool.
And tourists, again, at that time there were no fences around the White House. You could, in those days, you could still walk up to the front door, knock on the door, and be allowed in, and you could take a seat to see the president. So there were no fences around there, so a lot of the tourists that would come to the White House to see the president would pluck hair from Whitey's tail.
Oh, jeez, poor horse.
Poor horse.
Yeah.
They're taking the dog's fur and the horse's tail.
Oh, my. Now, when I was young, you could go right up to the White House. You couldn't go in the White House, but you could. There weren't huge fences around the White House.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I would assume... and I don't know this for a fact, but I would assume there were some barriers put around the White House during the war.
Yeah,
when FDR was in the White House, of course, just strictly because of the war being on.
Well, there was a fence around it when I was young, but you could go right into
the
West Wing, I think it was.
I think
you could walk right up to it.
Truthfully, I think that lasted all the way through Eisenhower's term, which would have ended in 60, when Kennedy took office. Yeah.
Right.
Less than 2 years after Taylor's inauguration, though, Old Whitey was the symbolic riderless horse because Taylor, of course, died while he was in office.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, tourists will stop at nothing to get a souvenir.
Now, the riderless horse, don't they put the boots on backwards?
Backwards, right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm,
yeah.
Right.
Amazing.
Right. Yeah, and I'm not sure what the symbolism of that is. I'm sure it has something to do with the death of the writer. But if you remember, they did that in Kennedy's cortege.
And there's there's all sorts of rules about if you have a statue of a warrior or a soldier, and the soldier died in battle,
in combat,
he's standing, or I don't know. There are all sorts of rules about what you can do with their statues. Is standing means something,
right.
Sitting means something else,
right.
So forth.
Yeah,
so.
I'm not familiar with
I
have heard of that, yes.
Okay, yeah. I'm sorry.
Speaking of horses, another famous horse was John Tyler, President Tyler's horse. His name was General. He was later buried at his master Sherwood Forest Plantation home in Virginia.
It had to be a big hole.
Yeah, well, there's some other ones that have that same knowledge. Rutherford Hayes, for instance, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
It always wasn't horses, though. At least three presidents shared the White House experience with cows. William Henry Harrison had a bovine named Suki that was a pet, Andrew Johnson brought along one or more of his cows with him when he came to the White House. William Howard Taft obtained household milk from his cow named Mooly Wooly. Isn't that a great name? Mooly Wooly.
That's a great name, yeah. And, they did a song about him, didn't they?
What's that?
They did a song about him, Mooly Wooly.
I think that was Mooly Wooly.
Yeah, okay.
And then a more productive Holstein named Pauline Wayne was the last known cow at the White House, and that was also one that was owned by William Howard Taft.
Oh,
Taft apparently loved his fresh milk, so
sure.
They were producing for him.
Good.
A handful of other White House pets generated history of the sort. Rutherford Hayes, for instance, goes down in history for introducing the Siamese cat to America. David Sickles, who was the American consul in Siam, had read that First Lady Rutherford, Mrs. Hayes, Lucy Hayes,
yeah,
loved cats, so he was the one that sent her a Siamese kitten, and later said that he was informed that this was the first attempt ever made to send a Siamese cat to America.
Huh. I'll be
as far as we know, that's true. And if you've ever been to Hayes' home, Spiegel Grove over in Fremont, have you been there before?
No, I have not been there.
Hayes, of course, and his wife are both buried on the property, and Hayes' horse is also buried on the property next to where they are buried.
Oh, how nice.
And that was a horse that he used during the Civil War when he was a general.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Dolly Madison, not only had rescued the famous Gilbert Stuart portrait of George Washington when the British burned the White House down during the War of 1812, but also she rescued the family pet, their parrot, which incidentally outlived both her and James Madison.
Oh, jeez.
And Dolly outlived James Madison by, I think, something like 25 years.
And the dog outlasted them both?
The parrot.
I mean the parrot.
Yeah, outlasted both of them, yeah.
I guess they do live pretty long.
Dolly Madison, kind of an interesting character, and she was very impoverished. After the president died, she did maintain a residence in Washington that was actually, she was allowed to live there rent-free, and I forget the name of the individual that gave her the residence. It was a member of Madison's cabinet, but she lived like 20 or 25 years beyond his death, and clear up until the time she died, she was still like the belle of Washington. But unfortunately, she had no source of income, and the slave who had been granted his freedom, I believe his name was Randolph, that helped her to remove, along with the gardener, who helped them to remove the portrait of George Washington out of the frame before the British burnt the White House.
Right.
He actually went on to, he kept a diary of his memoirs of his life and wrote a book, and he actually provided money for her to live on.
Oh, that's interesting.
Isn't this amazing? And this was Madison's personal slave that he had brought with him from Virginia when he went to the White House.
How ironic.
And, of course, was granted his freedom upon his death.
Yeah.
But he and Daniel Webster both contributed money to keep Dolly going after Madison died because she was basically penniless.
That's interesting. So, yeah.
Interesting sidebar.
Yeah, sure is.
One of the very first White House occupants to own a bird was Thomas Jefferson. His feathered companion was a mockingbird named Dick, or Dickie, as he was sometimes referred to.
Okay.
Dick's cage hung among the roses and geraniums in a window recess at the White House. So whenever the president was alone, he opened the cage and gave Dickie the freedom to fly around the room.
Oh, great.
The bird would sit on a table and sing, or would perch on the president's shoulder and take food from his lips.
And when you go into that room, you better look where you're going to sit down.
You might be where Dickie left.
Yes.
Most publicly, for a while, Jefferson was a host to grizzly bears.
Ooh.
That had been sent back to Washington by the Lewis and Clark expedition. Now, Meriwether Lewis was Roosevelt's personal Roosevelt was Jefferson's personal secretary.
Huh.
When Jefferson became president, and when Jefferson decided to send an entourage to try to find the Northwest Passage, he chose Meriwether Lewis, his private secretary, to lead the expedition. So I always found that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is.
But while they were on this expedition, they sent these bears back to the White House grounds, and they were oftentimes referred to as the president's bear garden. Not the president's rose garden, but the president's bear garden.
Now it's called the soccer pitch.
Yeah, right. another exotic animal briefly in residence of the White House was an alligator on loan, more or less.
They had some dangerous
animals.
John
Quincy Adams family. What's that?
They had some really dangerous animals.
Oh, they did. Yeah, it was great. Some of these early pets.
Bears and alligators and
And this
cows.
One, this particular alligator was given or on loan to John Quincy Adams, of course, the son of John Adams, by the Marquis de Lafayette.
Ooh.
And, of course, Lafayette, known for his help during the Revolutionary War and the French participation to the United States the Revolutionary War. And when he toured the United States in 1824 and 25, when he took the alligator back and returned back home to France with it. But the animal had spent many years in the White House in the East Room.
Did Lafayette live a long life? Or was he chomped up somewhere?
Well, the Revolution, of course, 1776, and he was touring the United States in 1825, I don't know how much longer he lived after that, but apparently he had a fairly decent life, but that's when he took the animal back to France with him. But for some time, that alligator stayed in the East Room of the White House. Can you imagine that? crazy.
Yep.
Crazy. Dwight Eisenhower was one president eager to get rid of some of the animals, not pets, but squirrels that kept digging holes in his pristine putting greens.
Oh, no. And he was a big golfer.
Yeah. He was the one that had that putting green installed, you know, when he became president.
I didn't know that.
First, his staff created a similar smooth grass for the pesky critters and covered it with nuts, but the animals simply refused to use both patches of grass and were constantly chewing up his putting green.
No, there must have been
something
there.
So the squirrels were then trapped and removed to the area of the Lincoln Memorial. Of course, some of them wandered back to their old White House haunt, and finally they were trapped again and moved to a park several miles away.
You don't imagine some of them were euthanized, do you?
Well, it doesn't say anything about them being euthanized, but, you know.
All right.
They don't always tell all the truth.
No, they don't tell the truth. Okay.
Among a few more pets seen in presidential homes over the last 200 years included John F. Kennedy's daughter Caroline had a pony named Macaroni. Remember Macaroni?
Yes, I do remember her, yeah.
Yeah, she. They used to ride that pony all over the grounds, and I remember there's a photograph of Caroline sitting on Macaroni that I've seen before.
Huh.
I'm not sure whether it was on the grounds of the White House or whether it was up on their property along the coast, but they also had another horse named Cleopatra, and some mockingbirds. Now, William McKinley had a pet parrot named Washington Post. Now, I have an interesting story about that particular parrot.
All right.
One time I was portraying William McKinley at one of our presidential dinners, and I kind of credit myself as being a minor historian on the William McKinley because of my relationship with the McKinley family. And I thought I knew most everything about the president and his family. And at this particular dinner, one of the people seated at my table asked me about my parrot. And quite frankly, I didn't remember having a parrot.
Okay.
I didn't remember anything about McKinley's parrot. So, of course, you know, you got to come up with an answer pretty quick when someone asks. You don't want to appear dumb because you are portraying that person.
Yeah.
The first thing came out of my mouth was, well, I didn't particularly like that parrot, and I don't want to talk about it. That's the way I got out of it. So after that dinner, of course, I started doing some research and found out that, yes, he did have a parrot named Washington Post.
Huh.
And he named it Washington Post because he was particularly fond of that march, the John Philip Sousa March, Washington Post. So that's how the parrot got its name.
Huh.
So I guess you learn something almost every day.
Yeah. Hey, I did. I just looked up Macaroni.
Yes.
He was a stout pony. He was a Shetland pony.
Shetland pony,
and he
yeah.
was very stout and, handsome critter. Okay.
Does it have a picture of Caroline sitting on
She's
the pony?
She's sitting right on Macaroni's back.
Yep. Lyndon Johnson, we mentioned earlier, he had beagles. The two that we got to see all the time were the two that were at the White House, him and her. A very original name, male and female, him and her. And I do remember that, I think I remember that press conference, or remember seeing a repeat of it or some pictures of it where he was holding that beagle by the ears off the ground. His feet were off the ground.
It's amazing.
He got into a lot of trouble with the USPCA over
that
whole thing.
He sure did. I remember that one, yeah.
Caught a lot of hell over it.
Yep.
But as he explained, you know, I've raised beagles my whole life because he was a great hunter.
Yep.
And he said, I've raised beagles my whole life, and this is the way we always pick the dogs up, by their ears. It didn't hurt them at all. Another one that we remember in recent history, George and Barbara Bush's dog, Millie.
Uh-huh.
Remember Millie?
Millie was actually an author.
Remember Millie wrote a book?
No, I didn't.
I'm sure Barbara Bush was the ghostwriter.
But
I remember her well. The Coolidge family had a mule, a couple of donkeys, and, of course, the president's favorite was Rebecca the raccoon.
Ooh.
Now, that raccoon, and I think I've seen a picture somewhere in our archives of that raccoon sitting on Coolidge's shoulder.
What was its name?
Rebecca.
Rebecca.
Yeah, it was a female raccoon raised from a baby, and it was it had the run of the White House. So, you know, wherever you saw Coolidge, usually the raccoon was just a few feet behind. I guess it stuck to him like glue. Over the years, there have been many, many other White House pets, too numerous to mention. Including in that were possums, sheep, an antelope, a bobcat, several fish, even elephants, and two tiger cubs.
Huh.
Now, the more exotic creatures, such as Martin Van Buren's tiger cubs or James Buchanan's elephants, were gifts from abroad. And, of course, they were turned over to the Washington Zoo, not kept there.
Yeah.
It was, however, Buchanan, who owned the quintessential symbol of America, he had a bald eagle.
I'm going to have to remember that, aren't I?
You have to remember that. He had a bald eagle.
I didn't.
Actually, he owned a pair of eagles, but instead of bringing them to the White House, he kept them at his private home, Wheatland, that was located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Huh. So, I just pulled up a picture of Rebecca the raccoon. Very handsome raccoon.
Yeah, and again, you know, it's strange what people will adopt as a pet.
Yeah, I think I'll pass on a raccoon, though.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like people that have skunks for pets.
Yeah, ooh, yeah.
You know, I knew a girl that had a pet skunk that she had raised from a baby, and I asked her one time, I said, what about the scent gland? She said, I had the scent gland removed.
Yeah. Well, now, so, the Kobels, I have a skunk that lives on my property and has greeted us more than once.
Oh, yeah, I've heard you talk about that skunk before. A few years ago, I was looking out the front door early one morning, and there were five baby skunks across the street underneath the pine tree. And I'm sure they had been orphaned. And eventually they disappeared. But over the years, we've had a skunk or two in the backyard. Especially certain times of year, these skunks will appear and they'll eat the grubs.
Oh, yeah.
Out of the yard. That's what they did. They dig little holes and get those grubs out of there.
Yeah, we have lots of little holes. I'm not sure if it's squirrels or if it's skunks or what.
I'll bet it could be either one. Of course, squirrels are either burying or digging up nuts that they've buried before. But I know the first time I noticed this, I asked James Anderson about it.
Yeah.
And because I had all these little holes in the yard, I thought, what the heck are these holes?
Yeah.
And I did remember seeing a skunk, and James said, they're actually digging grubs out of your yard.
I bet that's what's digging the little holes in my yard, because they're not real deep holes.
No, right, yeah. Right. You're just basically scratching the surface where the grub would be.
Yeah.
Well, the other topic I thought we'd cover today, and this will probably take us up to quitting time here.
Okay, we got about 20 minutes.
The other thing that people, I think, are always interested in is, you know, not only White House pets, but there's a couple things, like who was born there, who died there, who was married there, that type of thing.
That's
kind of what I'm doing these first couple of segments on, and then we'll talk about individual presidents, because I think we can really run this out over a couple of different sessions.
All right.
But I want to talk a little bit about, generally speaking, who died in the White House.
Yeah.
because it isn't always necessarily a president.
Oh, yeah,
that I have
course,
found out in my research and through this book. And again, no particular order, just the way I've written them down, I'm going to touch on this. But
okay.
Starting out with a relative of a president, U.S. Grant's father-in-law, who was a judge by the name of Frederick Lincoln Dent. Now, you remember the Dent, his wife was a Dent, and they were actually Southerners.
Okay.
He was a Confederate sympathizer, despite his middle name, or his daughter Julia's marriage to the Union general. And he died in 1873, basically of old age.
In the White House?
In the White House.
Huh.
Yes. These are all people that died within the confines of the White House.
So he must have had a little room there or something.
I'm sorry?
He must have had a room where he lived.
Yes,
there.
Right, absolutely. She, if I remember correctly, Julia had one of her sisters living in the White House at the time of the Civil War, because the sister's husband was a general in the Confederacy.
Yeah.
And they were having a dinner there, and I don't remember which senator or congressman was at the dinner with them, but when they found out that she was married to a Confederate general, politely or impolitely, got up and left the dinner.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
Because of that.
So, that's interesting.
You never know.
Yeah.
There was a slave child born in the White House.
Really?
An infant. And also died in the White House in January of 1803.
Huh.
And obviously it would have been, you know, one of Jefferson's slaves that
yeah.
was living at the White
now,
House.
Did
he
die
so,
in childbirth? Or?
Born and died, yeah. Huh. Second slave child born in Jefferson White House in 1806 was died by the end of 1808. And that was a record kept of a small coffin that had been ordered for the White House.
Oh,
that's
geez.
Where it was, the information was found.
Huh.
The first president to die in the White House, William Henry Harrison,
yeah.
in
okay.
April of 1841. And, of course, we all remember the story of William Henry Harrison during his inauguration, which lasted something like 2 hours. He caught cold and a fever
and
eventually yeah. died then just 1 month later.
Yeah, that's not a good story.
Well, unfortunately, it was a pouring down rain.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very cold March day. That's when the presidents were sworn in March,
yep.
inaugurated in March. And he, gave his inauguration speech without a hat or a coat.
And he could have shortened it a little bit, too.
I'm sorry?
If he had shortened it, it might have helped.
Might have helped a little bit, too, yeah, absolutely. The first president's wife to die in the White House was John Tyler's first wife, Letitia, in 1842, barely a year after, hardly more than a year after her husband succeeded the ill-fated William Henry Harrison. So that was kind of an interesting thing. She was young by today's standards. She was only 52 and, of course, had been in ill health before moving into the White House the year before.
What a pretty name.
Another Harrison, same family, but a later generation, Caroline Harrison, wife to President Benjamin Harrison. And, of course, we have a Benjamin Harrison and a Caroline Harrison that portray those people for us. He was William Henry Harrison's grandson, if you remember that.
Okay.
She was in her late 50s and died of tuberculosis in 1892. And then... misery upon misery, her father died later that same year. So Benjamin Harrison lost both his wife and his father-in-law within a year's time.
Now, was his father-in-law living in the White House? Or
yes,
was
he was.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Another presidential wife, Woodrow Wilson's first wife, Ellen, tuberculosis of the kidneys claimed her life. She was in her mid-50s, and that was in August of 1914. He was in Europe at the time, and, of course, World War I had just erupted then.
Yep.
The second president to die in the presidential home, Zachary Taylor, died in 1850.
Mm-hmm.
He had gone to a July 4th celebration in 1850. It was actually over on the lawn of the Washington Memorial. I think they were still in the process of erecting it, and they were doing a dedication, if memory serves me right. And he had been served, and I don't think this necessarily has anything to do with his death, but I'll bring it up because it's always been speculation. It was a very, very hot day, somewhere around 100 degrees out. He had been drinking ice water and eating fresh cherries at the time, and milk. Drinking ice water and eating fresh cherries and milk. And when he returned to the White House, he became ill, and he died 5 days later.
Huh.
Now, whether it had anything to do with the cherries and milk or the ice water and the temperature, I have no idea.
I can't imagine.
But,
I can't imagine any of those would have had anything to do with, like, food poisoning or anything.
Well, you don't know. But there is
maybe
speculation. If you read his biography, there is some speculation that it could have been a either a reaction to the strawberries, or it could have been food poisoning, sour milk. You just don't know.
Huh.
Or it may have absolutely nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Okay.
It's just like when Harding died in San Francisco, there was a lot of speculation going around that he had been poisoned by Mrs. Harding, and there was speculation going around that he had died from eating bad clams when they were on a boat up in Alaska. So, you know, who knows? There's always going to be some speculation attached to that.
And we don't have, back then we didn't have the forensics
going on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And when we talk about Garfield, we'll talk a little bit about that too.
Okay.
A president's son, young Willie Lincoln, who was only 12 years old, along with his younger brother Tad, both had fevers. They think it might have been typhoid. In the winter of 1862, Tad recovered, but Willie did not. So he died in the White House. After Willie's death, Abe Lincoln went to his secretary, John Nicolay, and sobbed and wept over his son's death. Mary Todd Lincoln went to bed and screamed until she fell asleep. During the funeral, 5 days later, an onlooker said that the sky was black and a fierce wind rolled up tin roofs in Washington and toppled chimneys and church steeples.
Yikes.
Now, I don't know whether that had anything to do with her or just a curiosity of the weather, but there you go. Another one of those superstitions.
She was a little crazy anyway, so that
absolutely
didn't help.
another presidential relative, Harry Truman's mother-in-law, Margaret Wallace, died December the 5th, 1952. 4 days after she had a mild stroke, and just a month after the American electorate had chosen Dwight Eisenhower to succeed Truman. So Truman was on his way out then, having lost the election in November of 52, but his mother-in-law passed away there in the White House. Woodrow Wilson was so affected by the death of his wife, Ellen, that he would not allow her remains to be placed in a coffin. I thought this was very unusual. He had her laid out on a sofa in the presidential bedroom, curtains pulled shut, and lights were down low. He stayed there with her for two nights. After her funeral service in the East Room, he rode the special train back to their hometown of Rome, her hometown of Rome, Georgia, staying all the while in the compartment with her casket. Never left her side. Never left her side.
Wow.
Caroline Harrison's death, we mentioned earlier, came in the last weeks of the presidential campaign, but neither her husband nor his Democratic opponent, Grover Cleveland, had done very much campaigning. Cleveland had only made one public appearance after learning of Mrs. Harrison's serious illness in 1892, and the incumbent Harrison stayed close to his dying wife all along. When it was announced that Cleveland had won the election, as the first and only president ever returned to office after leaving the White House, Harrison was very visibly relieved. He said, "For me, there's no sting in losing. Indeed, after the heavy blow of the death of my wife, I do not think that I could have stood the strain of a re-election and the problems that it would have brought." So apparently he wasn't too sad about being not being elected for that second term. And of course, fast forward to history, we have now a president that is contemplating being the second president to be elected to office with a term in between.
Yes.
Now, whether that will happen is...
You threw me off there. I'm trying to think who that was. Now, yes, of course.
Cleveland was defeated by Benjamin Harrison, and then came back and beat Benjamin Harrison very handily, I might add, for that second term. Visibly ill for several days, Zachary Taylor was treated by a doctor. We talked about him a little bit later. The doctor at the time was a doctor by the name of Miller. He was accused of having bled the dying William Henry Harrison a bit too much in 1841. Of course, it was very popular to bleed people.
My grandfather did bleeding.
Did he?
He was a doctor, and, well, he was born in the 1800s, so, he did that.
Well, there. Have you ever seen that tool that they used to
bleed? I have it.
It's a kind of a, I've been to a couple of different medical museums, and it's kind of a wicked-looking thing.
I have one in my basement right now.
What's that?
I have one in my basement right now.
Do you really?
That was my grandfather's, yes.
Yeah, well, they also used to use leeches to bleed people.
Yes, he
that
had
was,
leeches.
That was popular very, very early
in
the century. Taylor, in any case, was tormented by delirium, which he often just spoke utter nonsense while he was dying. Congress and the public awaited the frequent White House bulletins. Mississippi Senator Jeff Davis and his wife at the time, Verena, of course this is before the Civil War, were very often repeated visitors to Taylor because Taylor was Jefferson Davis's father-in-law. I think I might have mentioned that to you once before.
Yeah.
At the very last and final hours of his life, members of the cabinet and other officials waited in the upstairs room down the hall from his bedchamber for him to die. Those people that were there at the time of his death, of course, were his wife, Jefferson Davis, and his wife, Verena. Unfortunately, nothing they could do or say could change the outcome. The other one that I wanted to mention was James Garfield. Of course, Garfield was from Ohio, up around Mentor. And he was shot just a few months into his first term in, as president. He was in a railway station awaiting on a train. And, of course, back in those days, Secret Service protection for presidents was pretty minimal. So there weren't very many people around him, which kind of is strange because with the times and with the Civil War having passed and the turmoil that was still in the country because of Reconstruction, I'm surprised it didn't have more people around. But apparently a man who was a disgruntled office seeker, and I don't remember his name, he had a foreign name, but he came up and shot Garfield twice in the back while he was standing waiting on this train. He was then taken to the White House, where he laid throughout most of the summer. At first, they thought he was going to live, and he eventually became worse and was moved to somewhere up on the coast, where they thought the sea air would help his recovery. Interestingly enough, he was he could have probably been saved. At that time, Alexander Graham Bell had invented the forerunner to the X-ray machine. And they kept trying to use the X-ray machine to locate the bullet, because if they could find the one bullet, they were safely removed the first bullet, which did no damage. And the second bullet was located somewhere in his back, they thought, near the kidneys. And so they kept trying to use this new invention, the X-ray machine that Alexander Graham Bell had worked on, and it wasn't having any success. So they finally gave up trying to find and locate the bullet and remove it, so they moved him up to the coast, where eventually he died. He suffered a horrible death. He suffered immensely over those few months during the summer. But later on, they finally figured out, as the years progressed, historians figured out, that they could have probably found that bullet had he not been lying on a bed that had metal bed springs.
Oh, my.
And the metal bed springs was, of course, confusing the X-ray machine and not allowing them to appropriately identify or generally identify the location of the bullet. So,
pretty amazing.
Sad to say.
Yeah, sad to say.
And, of course, McKinley...
He didn't die in the White House, though.
No, he didn't die in the White House, no, but I just thought I'd bring that up because
sure.
It was an unusual death.
Yeah, it was.
But he laid in the White House and probably would have died there had they not moved him to the coast, thinking that might actually help him, yeah, you know, along the lines. But it didn't.
No. It would have helped me, but it probably didn't. I love being by the ocean, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
I can barely hear you.
I'm sorry.
I'm like I'm losing you.
Well, we do have that as a problem occasionally, yeah. I guess.
So that pretty much sums up the information I have on those people that died in the White House. How much time do we have left?
We got 3 minutes.
3 minutes left.
Yep.
Okay, well, I think I'll save the last 3 minutes to talk briefly about the Knight Heritage Hall again.
Yeah, please do that, yeah.
And then next time we'll talk about, we've talked about people who died there. We'll talk about people who were born there and people who got married there.
That'd be fun.
And see how much time we've got left after that.
All right.
All right, Knight Heritage Hall. Again, for those people that do not know what that is Marion County Historical Society's answer to the movie Night at the Museum. I can't think of the guy who started those movies.
I
can see his face, but I can't think of his name. He was Ann Mira's son, very popular guy. Anyway, that's where the characters come alive in the museum. So what we do with Knight at Heritage Hall is we darken the museum, not dark enough that you can't see where you're going,
right,
and we give you a flashlight when you come in. You buy a ticket at the door, either $5 if you're a member of the Historical Society, or $8 if you're not, and turn you loose with your flashlight, and you wander about the two floors of the Marion County Historical Society Museum, and you have a chance to encounter with up to 50 different characters from Marion's history and U.S. history and Ohio history. And they will talk to you. They'll tell you about themselves. They'll answer your questions about who they are. And you can go from character to character, and you can also get a glimpse of the new exhibit that will be opening in the museum on March the 26th.
Excellent.
Again, ticket sales are at the door only. There's no advance sales this year, so you don't have to call ahead for tickets. The doors will open at 5:45 to go in and buy your ticket. There will be some wood carvers and a candle maker that will be doing demonstrations in the auditorium while you're waiting to go into the museum. So if you get there a little bit early, you can watch some of that.
Okay.
And then at 6 o'clock, we'll open the doors to the museum, and you can start going in and either do the first floor or the second floor. It's entirely up to you. There'll be people there guiding you as to where you need to go, and you'll start meeting characters right off. One of the first characters you meet when you come in, excuse me, will be Dr. Charles Sawyer, who will be stationed in the Harding Rooms right there by the entrance. And he was the physician for both Warren Harding and Florence Harding when they lived in Marion. And also, when they went to Washington, when Harding was elected president, Harding took him along to the White House with him because he was treating Mrs. Harding for her kidney disease at the time.
Okay, and we only have about 20 seconds. So
okay. All right, again, March 26th, Knight Heritage Hall.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Fred Malone, and we will talk to you 1 month from right now.
All right. Enjoy your trip.
Okay, thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. Now.
Bye-bye. Fred Malone, our friend from the Marion Historical Society, and thanks for listening. We'll be back with the Swap Shop in about 15.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM LP Marion.